Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. On today's program, we've got education reporting from State Impact Ohio's Ida Liofskovsky. We've got a report on fracking from WKSU's Tim Rudell as well. Politics Ohio, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac, all that and more coming up. Up first this week, we reported on a couple of stories about people and organizations working in the community. Wilmington College has once again received recognition for its community service program. The college has made the president's Higher Education Community Service Honor Roll for the sixth consecutive year. The award is given based on the range of innovativeness of service programs and student and classroom participation. Tara Leidy is the college director for the Center for Service and Civic Engagement. She talks about her experience with the program and its inception.
I was a student at Wilmington College, and I remember my freshman year being recruited to serve in a student leadership position that was going to work with community service, and I believe that that was the first year the program began. That would have been in maybe the spring of 93, and it was with a small grant from the Ohio Campus Compact to start a service program, and I remember being assigned to Clint Memorial Hospital. That was my site, to help get other students that I knew involved in community service. And so from that point on, the program kind of grew. I ended up going back to the college after I graduated in 98 and was hired as the first standalone person to oversee the service program. And my title at that time was coordinator for service learning. Part of the strategic plan of the college was to split service into its own entity for more focus. And so that's really when I came on board in 98.
Now, part of the award is given on student and classroom participation. So this must be well received by the students. Do you need to encourage them, or are they right there at the ready?
A little bit of both. I think students today seem to be more primed to do service once they get to college. I think that's because a lot of high schools have service programs or active key clubs, things like that. And so we do get a good number of students that are ready to serve and are looking for that type of involvement in college. While on the other hand, we have a lot of students that have never volunteered a day in their life. And so it's our goal right from the get-go, even the very first weekend students are on campus during orientation, we expose them to their first service project, something that would diversify their experience, maybe enhance their interest in a particular career area. So where we don't require service on campus, we highly encourage it. It's directly linked to our mission. Being a Quaker College, service is right there at the heart of what we do. And so we try to instill that in students very early on. And it just becomes part of the culture.
You definitely have tremendous support from Wilmington College for this program. Any other final comments about the service award that you've received again now for 6 years in a row?
I think it's just nice to receive the recognition again. I know our students work really hard on doing whatever they can for our community. They're very focused locally on making things better. And any time that we see an opportunity where our students, our faculty or staff could serve, we try to take advantage of that. And in some cases, you know, we look for things beyond our local community, and maybe there's, you know, nationwide issues or even worldwide issues that our students will tap into. And, you know, one of the areas that, you know, they look at as far as criteria goes is our philanthropic programs as well, and students are very committed to that. We have big programs each year that students have started to really invest in and look forward to, like Relay for Life, that's coming up soon. We do our own collegiate version of that. It's just really exciting and rewarding to see students so invested in doing what they can to make the world that they live in better. And it's an honor to be able to serve them in my role and to expose them to as many issues as I can and many opportunities to serve others.
Tara, I just want to thank you for your time and for the information you've given us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tara Leidy, director for the Center for Service and Civic Engagement at Wilmington College. Students there contributed more than 15,500 hours of volunteer community service and raised almost $15,000 in charitable funds in the 2010-2011 academic year. Other institutions to receive the honor include Antioch University in Yellow Springs, Sinclair Community College, and the University of Dayton. Another service organization is touting its success in providing disaster relief for tornado victims in Indiana and southern Ohio. Tom Fodor is CEO of Dayton's Red Cross chapter. I made a minor slip-up at the beginning of our interview when I asked about the merger between the Dayton and Cincinnati Red Cross chapters.
Well, really, merger is a common term, but it's not really what happened when Cincinnati and Dayton started working together. Last year, at about the July time frame, the American Red Cross a couple years ago set up a new regional structure where larger chapters would work with surrounding chapters to standardize service delivery, to get a grip on some back office functions, to operate more effectively, and to serve their communities better. So in that regard, Dayton was actually a regional chapter that worked with five other chapters to accomplish those objectives. That occurred over 4 years ago. So the next edition of this occurred in July. And Cincinnati and Dayton were assigned to consolidate. That's really the term that we prefer using because the local footprints of the chapters involved did not go away. The five companion chapters in the old Dayton region, the Dayton region itself, still kept its offices, its local board of directors, its local mandates to serve the community and to work with emergency services directors in each county. So the actual operational focus and the community involvement of the Red Cross didn't change, just like it didn't change a couple years ago when Dayton was a region. It was just an evolution of trying to get more effective coverage of the entire country. So it's been a welcome change in many respect, and I think this tornado response really showed the effectiveness of taking a regional approach to disaster services.
Now give us a few details on that. This was the first time that the consolidation was put to the test.
It was, and that's a very good point, because before it was mostly informal. Like during Katrina, we would network and we would talk, but this was from the first inkling that we had to really respond in a significant fashion. And within a couple hours, our regional emergency service director, Fran O'Shaughnessy, had at her beck and call 36 counties worth of personnel, of supplies, and of expertise that would not have been possible just a couple years ago if the Red Cross had not gone to a regional structure. Because we had that in place already, that we had full cooperation already settled, already decided, and we knew who was in charge. So that kind of mobilization went a lot smoother than it would have been in the past. And within hours, we had shelters stood up. We had head volunteers going toward the Cincinnati area and the Disaster Operations Center at the Cincinnati headquarters. There were about 12 Dayton volunteers, and our major trucks were on their way. So the coordination, especially in the initial phases of our disaster response, was much improved because we had taken a regional 36-county approach thanks to the foresight of our national organization. It was a great demonstration of the value of having standards across a region, of having clear communication lines across the region, and a mobilization plan that made sense for our area. We were able to handle this response virtually without any other national assistance. That's something that we should all really be proud of. It shows that every community from Troy to West Liberty to Richmond, Indiana, down all the way to the Cincinnati area into Kentucky, we were all working together and prepared to respond to a large-scale event like this. And so it's a great endorsement of not only our structure in the Red Cross, but all the volunteers who were ready to go and to help their neighbors.
Any challenges that arose or anything that you realize needs a little polishing?
Well, I'd say that there's always some logistical challenges, including getting to and from the disaster sites because of the cleanup efforts, and we don't want to get in the way of safety personnel and so forth. So the usual things that come up surface. I think it did show us, though, on a constructive note, that we do need some more caseworkers in our 36-county area. And so we'll be looking to train some more volunteers. So when we're in like the second or third day of a response like this, that we will have people who are trained to connect people to Red Cross help or to other community resources in a more a broad-based fashion.
Tom, any final comments on the state of the American Red Cross and the services you're providing?
Well, right now we're into long-term recovery. We're working with VOAD, which is Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, in the stricken area. And this VOAD committee really has four areas of focus. Case management, which means getting people connected to the methods and the programs that can help them recover. Volunteers processing further donations, and also there's a spiritual and emotional coping component. And that's something that really struck me when I looked at what the Red Cross was providing during this disaster. We had over 1,600 health and mental health contacts, and that's a very hidden type of help dealing with the emotional component of sudden disaster. Is very significant, and we were able to provide that.
Tom Fodor, Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross of Greater Dayton Region. Tom, thanks for speaking with us.
And thank you very much for having me on.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Starting this year, Ohio is planning to toughen the way public schools are evaluated. Most schools are expected to drop a few grades under the new system. State Impact Ohio's Ida Liefskoski reports that all public schools are worried about getting downgraded, but the proposition is especially alarming to charter schools.
Ohio's charter school closure law, which has been around for a while, says if a charter is failing 2 out of 3 consecutive years, it automatically has to shut its doors. Under the new school evaluation guidelines, 10% of charter schools that get a C or higher today would get an F. Combine those two ingredients, and you've got a recipe for a panic attack. Charter school representatives aren't panicking yet, but officials like Dave Cash are lobbying furiously for the state to reconsider their plight.
For a charter school becomes much more than just a PR issue, becomes a survival issue, because it would potentially put many more schools that currently appear to be performing well into a category of not performing and doomed to close.
Cash is the director of the Ohio Association of Charter School Authorizers. He worries the combination of the new standards with the closure law could lead to many of Ohio's 300 charter schools shutting their doors all at once. Zanesville Community School in Southeast Ohio is a charter sponsored by the local public school district that targets students who have fallen behind. It got a C this past year, but according to estimates by the Ohio Department of Education, it would have an F under the new system.
And that's just a doodle, but I got tons of work at home.
That's bad news for students like Derek Humphrey, heard here showing off his artwork. Humphrey used to go to Zanesville High School, but a few months into the school year, he left.
My mom thought they were holding me back up there, and they kind of were. And then I was always getting picked on up there because of my height and stuff.
At 16 years old, Humphreys is just 4'9". He has attention deficit disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. He was held back a year in the first grade, he says, because he took too long to write his perfectly formed letters. Humphreys says he'd have nowhere to go if Zanesville Community, the charter school, shut down.
I'd end up doing homeschool, and I don't like homeschool. So.
In the new environment, he's making academic progress and back at grade level.
I came here 3 months into it probably and got done at least with my sophomore year in 4 months.
17-year-old Johnisha Allender also made impressive progress at the community school after getting into trouble with some pills that weren't prescribed for her.
I had taken some medicine and thought it was painkillers, but it wasn't. And then it, like, messed me all up, and I was in the hospital and stuff, so.
Allender says she won't be repeating that mistake. She just graduated ahead of schedule and plans to start hair design school this fall. But if it weren't for the community school,
I would have still had a whole nother year and probably summer school. Because when I was a sophomore, I failed like 3 classes. So I would have had to retake them this year and then all my senior year next year.
Bill Sims, president of the Ohio Alliance for Public Charter Schools, says the new school performance standards don't reflect the progress of students like Humphrey and Allender because they don't put enough emphasis on value added, a score that measures how much a student has learned over the course of a year.
It is entirely possible that you will have these urban charter schools making great gains with kids, accomplishing more than a year's worth of work in a year's period of time, but they can never achieve an A grade.
Charter advocates have started lobbying state officials to reconsider either the new evaluations or the closure law.
We've said that we would be perfectly willing to work with the charter schools and look at the legislation, and if there's particulars that need to be adjusted to be accommodating to this new system.
That's Matt Cohen with the Ohio Department of Education.
The closure laws are there because the General Assembly and folks believe that they need to be there. That's not going to go away, but we also don't want to make it such that charter schools are just dropping into a closure situation because of some artifact of other parts of the law. That's not our intent.
Both the federal government and the state legislature have yet to sign off on the proposed new school grading system. But Cohen says even if the new guidelines are approved, the prospect of hundreds of charters shutting down all at once is highly unlikely. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Ida Liaskovsky.
Up next on WISO Weekend, more news from around the state. So far, fracking in Ohio has been largely seen as an out-in-the-country kind of thing, in farmers' fields, on wooded hilltops. But Ohio Public Radio member station WKSU's Tim Rudell reports drilling rigs are popping up in some unexpected places.
Geological maps of Ohio's Utica and Marcellus shales don't include parks, highways, schools. What's above ground shows little about how those ancient seashores sprawl down below. That's why drillers for oil and gas in the sometimes 2-mile deep formations can be equally interested in a well in the middle of nowhere and one under a school.
So there's a real, I mean, whether it's a moral dilemma or not, the bottom line is it's here. We might as well be part of it.
Ruth Ann Rinto is superintendent of United Local Schools in Columbiana County. Their repeated levee failures have the system facing a $600,000 deficit.
So someone comes by and they go, how about we'll give you $200,000? How do you say no? And then somebody says, well, you know, your water might be bad. We might not even have kids to be drinking the water if we don't have the money to pay for our school.
The area is also a hotbed of shale gas drilling, and Rinto has signed 2 oil and gas leases to get that $200,000 in one-time revenue for the school district. As she sees it, public land and the value of the mineral rights should be used and benefit the public good. With about 3 million acres of Ohio's mineral rights leased by energy companies in the past year, drillers are looking far and wide for more well sites, including under schools, fairgrounds, parks, even under cemeteries. Not everyone is on board with that idea, however. Near the hamlet of Jewett in Harrison County, the board of the Jewett Sportsman and Farmers Club, a beautiful outdoor park in the hills just outside the village, got a court order to block horizontal drilling and fracking operations under club land. They don't actually own the mineral rights under the property. Those went to coal mining interests last century. But Cata's lawyer, Owen Beetham, who represents the club, says Harrison County's history with the ravages of surface mining leaves it sensitive to the issues related to industrializing the rural landscape.
I think you can draw a lot of parallels with the invention of strip mining. I mean, if you drive down most roads in eastern Ohio past farms, you'll see a small pump jack, maybe 200 square feet. Well, now you're talking about 500,000 square feet.
State parklands could be open to shale gas drilling, too. Governor John Kasich has championed the idea, and with fellow Republicans controlling the state legislature, it's expected to happen. Lawmakers have already passed a bill authorizing a state commission on oil and gas leasing. Kasich says the idea is to capture as much revenue as possible from state property, use it to pay for an income tax cut, and in that way let all Ohioans, not just landowners, benefit from the gas boom. In the case of another large batch of state land, money collected from drilling might go for something else. The Ohio Department of Transportation is actively exploring the possibility of leasing mineral rights under right-of-ways and associated grounds of the state highway system. The department's Steve Faulkner.
Looking at the mineral rights that ODOT currently owns is part of our process of looking at ways of generating revenue. It's a matter of actually going to the courthouse and flipping through these dusty records and seeing exactly what the mineral rights are for certain parcels of land. And that's what we're in the process of doing.
Faulkner says gas and oil money from drilling on and under highway property could help pay for major road and bridge projects stalled by the economic downturn. Ohio colleges and universities are targets for drilling, too, and Kent State University, with its 8 campuses, already has experience with leasing with conventional drilling. But Tom Euclid, Associate Vice President for Facilities Planning and Operations, says the university recognizes potential problems with fracking and is going slowly.
We have existing wells on our campuses. Several of our campuses have gas wells and oil wells, but the university doesn't have any plans right now to do any additional deep exploration, such as fracking, until we understand more about the fracking process and how it might impact the land that we sit on and the water table that sits below us.
Data released last month by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources indicates total lease payments in the current shale gas and oil boom have topped $7 billion. There are no figures yet on how many acres of state land might still be leasable, but the current average for upfront payment is $2,500 per acre.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Tim Rudell.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking to Richard Vetter, an economics professor at Ohio University, about Ohio becoming a right-to-work state. Rich is one of 3 authors of a recent report that says Ohio should prohibit companies from requiring their employees to join a union as a condition of getting a job. Thanks for talking with me today, Rich.
Glad to be with you, Ellen.
A group called Ohioans for Workplace Freedom wants Ohio to join 24 other states and adopt a right-to-work law. That question could be on the statewide ballot in 2013. In your report, you say that the annual personal income of a family of 4 would on average be $12,000 more if Ohio had passed a right-to-work law in 1977. What's the evidence to support that?
It's based on a statistical examination of the behavior of people in right-to-work states compared with the behavior of workers in non-right-to-work states. We find that on average in right-to-work states, there's a greater growth of jobs, of incomes, of capital formation. And with that, of course, comes greater opportunities for workers and higher wage incomes.
A lot of economists believe that the principal reason for Ohio's economic decline in recent decades has been the loss of manufacturing jobs, many of which have gone not to right-to-work states, but to foreign countries. How can you isolate how much it's costing Ohio because we're not a right-to-work state?
There is no question that globalization has had a significant impact on Ohio. I would add that one of the reasons why manufacturing has fled the United States, and Ohio in particular, has been high labor costs. And those high labor costs have been partially attributed to labor union policies and agreements which were reached in some cases decades ago.
Just 14% of Ohioans belong to a labor union today, while 50 years ago that number was 35%. Just because someone is in a union doesn't mean they were made to join the union. How prevalent is the requirement that workers have to join a union to keep their jobs?
As you mentioned, if we have 14% in unions, we have 86% who are not in unions. And within the other 14%, a very large percentage of them now are public employees.
If the numbers are so low, would it be fair to say that this is more a partisan political debate than a public policy debate?
Well, I'm sure some view it as a partisan matter. I'm an economist, and I look at just the evidence. And I see that the evidence has been that states with right-to-work laws have had more robust economic growth. Ohio has a very serious growth deficit problem. We have gone from well above the national average to well below. We've lost a lot of businesses for the Dayton area. NCR is, of course, the poster child example. So this is just one of many tools, I think, that could be used to deal with the problem.
Tell us what your critics say that you're getting wrong and make the case for why they're mistaken.
The critics will say, with some truth, that without right-to-work laws, which are still a majority of the states, that wages on average are higher in those states than in right-to-work states. I don't think that tells much of the story, because the gap between the right-to-work and non-right-to-work states in that regard has narrowed dramatically.
Ohioans turned down a right-to-work initiative in 1958 by an overwhelming 2-to-1 margin. Meanwhile, last fall, Senate Bill 5, which would have limited the collective bargaining rights of public employees, was defeated 60-40. Now, I know there are surveys out there that say voters would support making Ohio a right-to-work state, but if I'm a politician who's being asked to endorse this effort, wouldn't the actual voting records of Ohioans be more convincing than surveys that were conducted before there's really been any public campaign about this?
You can assess the evidence both ways. And as unionization declines in the United States, the Midwest continues to suffer relative to the rest of the nation. I think people are looking for new options, new ways to make us competitive, and I think this is a tool in the arsenal.
I've been talking with Richard Vedder, an economics professor at Ohio University. It's always great talking with you, Rich. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ellen.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of middle spring. Keeping a notebook of what happens every day in the small world around me, I often think about the cyclical quality of events in nature. The repetitions of the sky and the landscape are something similar to what sociologist Charles Taylor describes as higher time in his study of the rise of humanism, a secular age. Taylor draws a distinction there between secular or sequential time and what he calls higher time. In secular time, says Taylor, one thing happens after another, and when something is past, it's past. Higher time, on the other hand, dramatizes cycles like those represented in the Christian liturgical calendar or in the repeating cycle of the year. And even though the modern world seems to do business completely in secular time, the alternate viewpoint persists and may even be dominant inside memory. Memory time is always higher time. Not only does memory retain a whole impression of experience, but it also blends, erases, and resequences pieces of the past, allowing the feasts of birth and death, love and disappointment to return, mellow or fester, winnowed to their core. So too with observation of the natural year. The repetition of the seasons within the mind mixes and combines the years, unifies them, re-evaluates them, distortions showing the selective power of emotion and insight over linear statistics. To withdraw from secular time is to come home to a centered self, where experiences are sifted and unified and made whole to return again. Like a book of days, the mind recollects choices and destinies, showing and combining In the radii of its vortex, the higher shadows and auras of repeating suns. This is Bill Felker with Poor Wells Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of middle spring. In the meantime, look for redbud and crabapple trees to come into bloom.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on WYSO. Coming up next, the Book Nook. But before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Person, Place, Thing is a reinvented interview show. The idea is that people reveal themselves the most when they talk about something they feel strongly about, not when they talk about themselves. Guests come prepared to talk about a person, a place, and a thing that are important to them, whether they love it or hate it. This week, Daily Show correspondent Samantha Bee talks about her mother, Canadian bagels, and a jungle hotel in Cuba. We'll also hear from R.L. Stine, author of the Goosebumps books. His person is Mad Magazine illustrator Will Elder, and his place is the mysterious pile of stones in the woods behind his childhood home in Columbus, Ohio. Person, Place, Thing, hosted by Randy Cohen. Tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
You're listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley.